I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
The fight in Congress over a national voting rights bill intensifies in Washington, with Georgia as one of the main exhibits. Meanwhile, right here, lawsuits are flying on both sides. Looking to the elections this year and next, one familiar name could end up in a new contest, while another talks about why she passed up a bid for another term. And Georgia's COVID-19 restrictions continue to disappear, but the fight over the state's response will continue for a long time. Just a sampling of what's on the bill of fare for this edition of The Political Breakfast. You are cordially invited. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Republican strategist Brian Robinson is here, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson returns after a couple of weeks off. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Dennis.
I'm back.
Glad to have you, too. And we are talking about Georgia's new voting law, but this time in a larger context. President Biden ramped up the already intense fight over voting rights this week. He named Vice President Harris as his point person in a campaign to get the Senate to pass a big new federal voting rights bill. Georgia's new voting law is one of the main talking points in that debate. But back here, the fight has shifted from the legislative branch to the judicial one. There are lawsuits on both sides. By one count, there are already at least 7 lawsuits challenging the law. And now there's one from the other side, a business advocacy group based in Texas called the Job Creators Network. It is suing Major League Baseball over its decision to pull this year's All-Star game out of the Braves' home in Cobb County. The suit seeks $100 million in actual damages and $1 billion, with a B, dollars in punitive damages. And the argument from the Job Creators Network is that the organization itself was harmed by baseball's decision because it had to divert its resources to help small businesses affected by the decision in Cobb County and in the Atlanta area. Brian, Major League Baseball, as far as we know, had no contractual relationship with the Job Creators Network, so there's not like there's some breach here. So wouldn't it be hard to legally argue some sort of breach? And so is this more of a political offensive than a legal one?
I'm fine with it being a political statement of some sort and keeping the heat and the attention on Major League Baseball for its cretinous, for its cynicism in what it did.
But are the courts the place to do that? I mean, the courts are already clogged up.
Well, I don't see liberals complaining about all the statements being made by Fair Fight Action in court for cases that they lose one after the other because they spout political rhetoric that the media doesn't call them on, and then they go to court and the Stacey Says standard doesn't work anymore. It is the legal standard. For example, Stacey Abrams, I saw her on CBS Sunday Morning a few weeks ago, and she was saying that black people wait in line for 8 hours to vote and white people stand in line for 7 minutes. I mean, she said that. Nobody questioned it. And in fact, Fair Fight went to court and lost on that very argument because the data showed that white Georgians and black Georgians stayed in line for the same amount of time. The difference was about a minute. So these sort of things happen in court all the time. And I am glad this group is doing this. Major League Baseball deserves to suffer consequences. And even if they don't lose in court, And, you know, the lawyers that WABE interviewed about this say that there's no way they'll lose in court. Fine, whatever. But I want them to have negative PR because of what they did to Georgia. Because now we're seeing how hollow this move was. You know, Florida passed the law, not a word, not a word. Not only no punitive actions, not a word. Texas has taken similar steps with a law much more stringent than what Georgia did. Not a word. There's no holier-than-thou statements coming out anymore because they know this is bad PR. They deserve that. And this just keeps that pressure on.
And Theron, Brian mentioned Stacey Abrams again. We should point out here that so far she has declined our invitation to join us on Political Breakfast because she has been brought up so often. But we haven't given up yet. Go ahead, Theron.
Yeah, and I'm glad you updated our listeners on that, Dennis. Thank you for reaching out to her. And it's good to be back. I mean, my good friend Brian is just really fired up this morning. But no, it's really good to be back, guys. And thank you to all the folks who filled in while I was on my
reach. Michael Owens and Nabila Islam. Nabila, thanks to them. Yeah. Welcome back, Theron.
So, you know, let's just not dive in here. And I think the thing that I want to, you know, again, always sort of remind our listeners is let's go back to the premise. And the premise and the reason for doing it is because Republicans passed Senate Bill 202. When you start from that premise, then you can go now and have a conversation that has a legal aspect to it, and that is this lawsuit. Because we know that there were expectations of hundreds of millions of dollars that were going to be generated, not only for small business owners in Cobb County, but it was just going to benefit business in Georgia in its totality, right? And so when you have that many people coming to any county in the country, but particularly Cobb County, it was going to have a positive impact on that community, not just financially, but also just highlighting Cobb County is now being, you know, a county that has changed in a lot in the last few years, not demographically, but economically. You got a new county commission chair there in Lisa Cupid, who was looking at this being sort of one of the big things that the county that now she's in charge of operating, we're going to be able to highlight. I don't know where this lawsuit will end up, Dennis, but I will tell you it does sort of reopen a wound that I want to sort of close, and that is allowing Republicans and others to, you know, bring back up this sort of conversation about cancel culture and blame the MLB and try to embarrass them. I think that that's something that Republicans feel that is a good talking point for them. We as Democrats, the fact still remains, we lost this all-star game because the Republican Party in Georgia, particularly in the state legislature, passed one of the most restrictive bills, I believe, in the country when it comes to voting.
Well, Brian, you talked about the argument about disproportionate effects and the waiting line argument that you say, look, that doesn't hold any water. Let's take a look at another argument about disproportionate effects of the new law. An analysis by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution found that the state's new law would disproportionately affect Black voters who, more often than white ones, would have to file extra paperwork if they wanted to vote absentee by mail. This because they don't have a driver's license or state-issued ID on file, and that's now a requirement instead of just matching the signatures. The AJC analysis found that more than half of the voters who are in that situation are Black, and they live in Democratic counties. Brian, this law came after an election with signature match in which there were only a handful of allegations of fraudulent voting. So couldn't the timing of this requirement, this new requirement, be used as an argument that Republicans want to make it harder for certain folks to vote absentee after the GOP lost an election, in part because African-American voters used absentee voting in unprecedented numbers because of the pandemic and decided they liked it?
Everybody used absentee voting during the pandemic because they had to.
But the argument here is that going forward, disproportionate numbers of Black voters would be affected by this new requirement, making it harder for them to vote absentee by mail again.
Yeah, let's dig in on this. You're talking about a tiny percentage of the Georgia population. And so what they're doing is they're taking this tiny percentage and saying, of this tiny percentage, this disproportionately impacts non-white Georgians. I would argue, statistically, that doesn't disenfranchise anybody. And people who don't have IDs, for the most part, aren't voters. The fact is, the law also allows every Georgian to get a free ID if they need one. So this seemed like a lot of work to research all this, and it's fine. I appreciate the knowledge. I think the more informed we are, the better about how this is going to play out. But that law will not disenfranchise one person, not one person.
So here's a fundamental difference, Dennis, that the Democrats and the Republicans have about voting in Georgia. What the Republicans should be saying, Dennis, is that we're in charge. We have a Secretary of State who has been sort of weakened in a lot of respects because of Senate Bill 202, removing his authority and power to oversee elections. He's become even more restricted with his lack of a role on the state board that will oversee these elections. But what Republicans should be saying, Dennis, is that we're going to work to make sure that every Georgian, he or she, who is eligible to vote and who wants to vote, to give them the access to vote. And we're going to make sure that we take this study that was done by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're going to work with this group, and we're going to find these roughly 272,000 registered voters who do not have a driver's license or a state ID. And we're going to do everything we can to get them the proper information and the proper resources to vote. That's what they should be saying. And so to me, that's where the Republicans will continue to struggle, is because they give people like Stacey Abrams and Fair Fight Action and me and others an opportunity to say, why are you not working with these individuals to give them these IDs? Now, I know we're going to talk about Speaker Ralston a little later on today and in regards to something else, but he did introduce, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, I mean, he said it during the past legislative session that we should, you know, give free IDs to every Georgian. You know, every Georgian who wants a free state ID, we should give it to them for free. And, you know, I always say this, Brian knows I laugh about this, but, you know, Democrats, you know, most times we like free stuff, right?
So,
but that's where the messaging is a challenge for the Republicans, and that you're going to see us as a Democrats continue to capitalize on the lack of leadership that is working with the available means to make sure that every voter, particularly these 272,000 registered voters who don't have an ID or a driver's license in Georgia.
Brian, you mentioned what a tiny percentage that is of the electorate, but isn't that exactly the point? The margins in Georgia are so small right now in statewide and national elections that if just a few people don't vote, that could swing an entire election. And the argument from Democrats and voting rights advocates is that's exactly what Republicans are trying to do, not prevent people on a large scale from voting, but just prevent enough people from voting to swing an election.
Shouldn't it bother Democrats, in fact, bother all of us, the idea of someone who cannot prove who they are in any capacity having a ballot? Nobody thinks that's a good idea, but that's exactly what we're talking about here. This is a security measure that is effective and is a low bar to entry, very low bar. All it is you have to prove who you are, which, by the way, is the standard that we use across society. I have to show who I am at the airport. I have to show who I am when I'm hooking up cable or power to my house. This is standard.
Granted, but the numbers argument here, the question was about, is the idea here to, however valid, the reason for it swing an election by affecting one group of people more than another?
Well, I could tell you, a lot of Republicans would argue, and I think maybe even some independents would argue, that if an election is determined by voters who can't prove who they are, there is a problem with the validity, with the credibility of that election.
Dennis, you know, this one actually kind of hits home for me personally. You know, as you guys know, I grew up in Athens, Georgia, and Brian went to school there. And Dennis, you spent a lot of time in Athens. But there's a little small county called Oconee County right next to Athens, right? And I'm sure Brian had many, you know, parties over there having a good time because, you know, that's where all the sort of wealthier folks kind of live in Athens. But my grandparents grew up in Farmington, Georgia, right outside Watkinsville. And my grandmother, Dennis, could not read or write. My grandmother had 14 kids. My mother is the oldest daughter. But more importantly, Dennis, she never learned how to drive. So I remember as a young kid in Athens when my mom would take me to the voting booth, and my grandmother did not have a driver's license. So what did she do when she had to bring proof of residency? Proof, whether it's a Georgia Power bill, and shout out to Georgia Power, or whether it was a water bill from the Athens, Clark County, or Oconee County Water Department. And then we finally got her to a point where she went and got a state issue ID. But the one thing about this study, Dennis, that I want to point out for our listeners, it also showed that 80,000 of these 272,000 registered voters actually have IDs, but the information isn't matched yet in the election data. So therefore, even if they have this ID, Dennis, they can't use it because there's still a glitch, there's still a disconnect within the system. And so the reason I bring up my grandmother, Alberta Thomas, because she had the will and she had the desire to exercise her fundamental right to vote every single election in Athens. She should not have been denied that right to vote, and she wasn't. But had she not had my mother and my cousins and her brothers and sisters to help her along, to drive her, to help her get a state ID, then she wouldn't have been able to vote. But again, this is a missed opportunity, Dennis, for Republicans. Democrats, we're saying every voter. So what if it's just one voter, two voters, no matter their color of their skin, no matter where they live, they should have the access to vote. Republicans should be saying, I'm going to make sure that 80,000 number, that we get on this immediately. And then what they could do, because, you know, press conferences are still kind of hip now, you know, media will show up. They could then talk about, hey, look at what we've done. We've removed 50% of the 80,000 people that data didn't match in the system to make sure that they now are eligible to use their ID to vote. But again, they're not wanting to expand the electric, Dennis, because they know that majority of these 272 registered voters are of color, particularly Black voters. And we know that in Georgia, still 90% of African-American voters vote Democrats. So there is no desire for the Republicans to try to get these folks on the voting rolls. And like you said, Dennis, they took away signature match. So many of these people who had to vote absentee because of this deadly pandemic, now they're not going to be able to do the signature match anymore because now you have to have this ID.
Yeah. You know what? We're going there from a subjective standard with the signature ID to an objective standard with the photo ID. And I think that's Theron's story about his grandmother is moving and very telling about a time in our history, about how things used to be, a time when perhaps a much more significant portion of our population did not have IDs because, you know, they didn't need a passport. They weren't going anywhere. They didn't need a driver's license. They weren't driving anywhere. I think a lot of that has changed in the intervening years. It is fairly universal now. Obviously, there is a sliver of our population that doesn't have an ID. But again, they can get them for free under this law. I think it's an important component here. And there is something worthwhile, much more than worthwhile, actually, in ensuring that our elections have integrity, that the people who show up to vote are legally eligible to vote. That's all this does.
Let me get a quick yes or no from both of you. Theron, I'll start with you. Are Democrats and voting rights advocates thinking that this particular provision of the bill might be the key to successful lawsuits against it?
Yes, I think they think that this particular provision and maybe a couple others are going to give them a good opportunity to legally push back on some of the provisions in this law.
Brian, are Republicans worried that this particular provision might be the one that they have to prepare the most for when it comes to legal challenges?
No, because federal courts have ruled, particularly in the last decade, that photo ID is perfectly legit and allowable.
On a related subject, in a way, Brian, you mentioned just a moment ago the way things used to be. Well, this week marked 100 years since the Tulsa Massacre, the rampage by a white mob in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which took the lives of as many as 300 black residents of the city and destroyed the thriving Greenwood business district, often called Black Wall Street. Now, President Biden visited Tulsa. He met with some survivors and descendants of massacre victims. But Tulsa was just one city where this kind of thing happened. Atlanta is another. In 1906, fueled by incendiary newspaper headlines, among other things, attacks on Atlanta's black neighborhoods took 26 lives by the official count, although many historians think it was much higher. Now, incidents like this were buried for decades when school students learned their history. And now, as we discussed in our last podcast, the debate over what can be taught and how has reached a new level of intensity. Brian, as we speak, the state school board is looking at a policy that would protect students from being taught that they should feel guilt or anguish or other forms of distress because of their race or sex. Now, that sounds simple enough. You don't tell someone they should feel bad. But is this so vague that uncomfortable facts won't be taught because of just how hearing those facts might make individual students feel uncomfortable?
No. At no point in our history have we not talked about Jim Crow and slavery. It's always been part of it, even at a time in our country that was much more conservative in its viewpoints on these issues than it is today. We have to let children know this history at age-appropriate times. My issue with critical race theory, which we discussed last week, isn't so much in telling children that we have a nation that's had some horrors. I think we have to do that. History's no good to us if we aren't informed, because it keeps us from repeating the horrible. So I want it taught. The thing about the CRT is telling people that America is inherently racist, because I don't believe that. You know, as Theron was just saying, he had a grandmother who was illiterate and didn't have a driver's license. And now he is married to a doctor and lives in Buckhead and has a successful business. And that is the American story. And that is the American dream that still exists. I think it's better for all Americans to teach this is the greatest country in the world, that it is a land of opportunity if you work hard and play by the rules. If we teach each other, if we teach the next generations that America is irredeemably bad, who puts on a uniform to defend that country in war against equally flawed countries? No one. We undermine patriotism. We undermine our future and our own defense with that teaching. That in no way means don't tell the horrible truths and pretend like they didn't happen. It's very upsetting, a lot of what is in our history. And we've got to be able to draw our own conclusions about it and vow to do better, but at the same time, love our country.
But are we on the brink through a policy or even a suggestion at the statewide level to local districts, hey, don't even go near these facts if it makes people feel uncomfortable?
No, because I think we all know that's not true. There is this fear of telling white children that they carry the burden of responsibility for things that white people of earlier generations committed. I think that is part, it is a visceral reaction amongst white parents. You know, how dare you say this to my child? And we're seeing that pop up. We're seeing the news stories now at these meetings, in the counties around Atlanta with the school boards. This is something that white parents, and I'm singling out white parents because that's what we're talking about, right? And this is a real hot button issue.
You know, the challenge here is, Dennis, we cannot cherry pick how we want to talk about the history of this country. You got to tell the history in its totality. And unfortunately, for some people, particularly white Americans, when you start talking about what happened in Tulsa, to Brian's point, let's bring it home here for a second in Atlanta. Herman J. Russell, who created the now still the largest African-American owned construction company in the world, shared this story with me about the Atlanta massacre. Jesse Hill Jr., who has a street named after him in Atlanta, who was a very, very successful businessman, who quite frankly funded a lot of the aspects of the civil rights movement with Dr. King and provided the legal fees to lawyers to make sure that they had the legal research and the intelligent lawyers to really push the policy with the civil rights movement. They shared these stories with me, Dennis. And they talked about how this was just not like a riot in Atlanta. This was an all-out surprise attack that was strategically and surgically aimed at Black people, but particularly Black business owners in a geographical area in Atlanta that was solely there to make sure that Black businesses thrived. And so when we talk about Atlanta, this is my whole conversation about where you can't just talk about the good things of Georgia and Atlanta without talking about the bad things. And the last thing I'll say, Dennis, is this. It doesn't make us un-American that we want to talk about it. We should talk about critical race theory in the school, right? You should have the teachers tell the good, the bad, the ugly about our country's history. But don't make people like me and others, and particularly Black Americans, un-American and that we don't love our country because we want to highlight a portion of our history that shapes the fabric of this country. And there lies where I think to all of my brothers and sisters in the white community who I've had many conversations with about race, I just opened up and told the world that I had a grandmother who couldn't read or write, right? But this woman raised 14 kids, worked her butt off every single day, working 3 and 4 jobs, was a homeowner. She still has a home in Athens, Georgia, right now in Newtown, which is a very gentrified neighborhood, because my family has come together to say, we're not going to sell this home because we want to keep it in the family because that's what my grandmother would want. Again, Republicans and others, and I want to commend Brian for saying that the Tulsa massacre and what happened in Atlanta was a terrifying moment in our history that should be talked about and it should never happen again. But we can't run away from having these conversations about race, and we cannot make people feel un-American and that you don't love your country because you want to talk about it. Therein lies, I think, the challenge that some leaders have got to figure out a way to come together and have that conversation and make everyone feel like though we have differences and we grew up in a different sort of time and era with different circumstances, but we can, as Americans, still have this conversation and not be frowned upon.
We should point out here that back in 2016, on the 110th year following the Atlanta massacre, WABE did an extensive series on it, and I think you can still check that out at wabe.org. Very quickly from both of you, though, Theron, I'll start with you. Do you think that in trying to formulate a message at the state level that kids should not be told they should feel uncomfortable, that that will have the unintended consequence that local districts will just shy away from even presenting facts because kids might feel uncomfortable even if they're not being told they should feel that way?
I think the one thing we got to highlight, Dennis, is that children today, particularly students who are in elementary school, middle school, we got to realize that they're more mature than we think they are. They can actually have this conversation in a sometimes more mature way than adults. Because guess what? Their mind hasn't really been shaped as much to be so impressionable that they need to be given this information raw and let them decide how they want to interpret it. And then it's left up to the parents to say, okay, you learned this in school today. But they come home, they have conversations with their parents, their grandparents, or their friends, and let them determine how they want to view the information that they have received. And I think we got to have more faith in our young people to know that they are mature enough to have the conversation.
Brian, real quickly, the unintended consequence idea.
You know, all history to some degree involves cherry picking. I mean, we have to leave out a lot because we can only teach our kids so much. And I don't believe in sugarcoating it. There's absolutely some horrors that are stomach churning. You know, as far as sugarcoating it for our kids, I think this needs to be age appropriate. Like I'm a middle-aged man, and the Tulsa Massacre stories are upsetting to me. I mean, they are emotionally upsetting to me. I want my kid to understand the true history of Georgia and of our country, because I want her to be part of a generation that's better. And she's going to be, at least on those issues. They're going to be more enlightened. They're going to be more broad-minded and humanitarian in how they approach them. And that is what is great about America, is the arc of the universe has bent toward justice here. And my plea is that we don't lose sight of that, that we just focus on the horrors, the fact that there were unfair laws, that there were brutal laws that subjugated a portion of our population. Let's also remember that we've come a long way, and today we are getting closer to living out our creed.
And there is much more ahead on The Political Breakfast, a familiar political name possibly in a new campaign, and another political name explaining why she passed up her next one. That and more when The Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here. And we are back on The Political Breakfast. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare, along with Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. During this past week, outgoing Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms sat down with our WABE colleague and Closer Look host Rose Scott for an extended conversation about Mayor Bottoms' 4 years as mayor and her decision not to run for a second term. You can check out that entire interview at WABE.org or on the Closer Look podcast. The mayor again said her decision was a personal one, rooted in her faith, among other things. But again, she did not mention any specific considerations that played a role in it. She also talked about how long it took to put together her administration after 8 years of Mayor Kasim Reed. Mayor Bottoms said that within a very short time, she knew which staffers she needed to replace. But she defended herself against the criticism that it took her too long to do that.
I finally, it's interesting, as I've announced that I'm not running, I finally feel like I have the team in place that's right for
me. In year four of your first and only term, now you feel like you have that team in place.
And I had heard that it would really take 4 years to get a team in place. And I thought, no way. But with every person you move out, you know, another plug begins to leak and you realize where your strengths and your weaknesses are. And that's probably not any different from any leader.
Theron, voters elect folks like mayors and governors and presidents to turn their promises and their proposals into reality. And of course, that does take time. But can you understand why someone might say, as Rose did, only now in your final year have you got your team in place?
Well, first of all, let's give a big shout out to Rose for doing this interview. It was a very comprehensive interview that was, by the way, conducted in Cascade Springs Nature Preserve, which is in Southwest Atlanta. And so, you know, while we spent a lot of time talking about Buckhead on this podcast, I want our listeners to know nationally that we do have a Southwest Atlanta area that is thriving, particularly with very affluent African-American residents. Dennis, I'm so happy you taking some time to talk about this on the podcast, because I can bring a very unique perspective to this, not just because I'm close to the mayor and two of us, we've actually had this discussion about her feeling like this was the year where she finally had the right culture, the right synergy amongst the team. What she was saying, and I want to make sure our listeners don't misconstrue what she was saying, it's not that it took her almost 4 years to get a staff in place. What she's saying is that when she walked in there in January of 2018, she had to work with the staff members that were there, which, you know, I said on a previous podcast that a majority of those members I have great relationships with. I know a lot of them personally. Many of them who came over from the previous administration were good folks. I mean, they worked very hard. They loved the city. But we did have a few people that unfortunately made some very bad decisions, and legally they had to pay for it. And some of them went to jail. I mean, I'm just going to be very blunt about it.
But the criticism has been that it took her a while even to replace those people.
Well, she also said, Dennis, in her press conference, let's make sure we give our listeners the full scope, that she said that one of the things that she did regret is that she would have moved sooner to bring in her own team. And that would have caused her to force a lot of these folks to resign. But here's why I have the unique perspective, Dennis. And I think I'm the only one on this podcast that actually has worked in city government in a mayor's office, right? I've worked for two mayors. I worked for former Mayor Bill Campbell, and I also worked for former Mayor Kasim Reed. And I was there a part of the transition with Mayor Bottoms. When you step into that office, you have to either just do what Shirley Franklin did, who's a former mayor, and fire everyone and then build it back up, or you have to basically do what the mayor did, and that is, let me strategically bring in a few members that I trust that were from the campaign, from the community. But the majority of the people she had, Dennis, the city had to keep running. She just couldn't go fire everyone. And she said that she probably would have done that differently. So what the mayor is saying now is that she has senior leadership in place, particularly with her chief of staff and her chief operating officer and others that have been able to put people in the right positions to now have a flow that she's comfortable with as far as the synergy and the culture. But I think the one thing that Atlantans love about the mayor, Dennis, and Rose actually kind of pulled this out of her in the interview, is that she's not going to sugarcoat it. She's okay with saying that, hey, this is something that I just have been able to do. But I just want to make sure our listeners don't think that the mayor, you know, she went through a few chiefs of staff. She went through a few chief operating officers. Her communications team changed. Her watershed commissioner changed. Her public works commissioner changed. Her CIO changed. You know, let's not even forget the police chief changed. I mean, and also airport general manager recently just changed. And she also said in an interview, to make sure we quote her correctly, that she had been told by previous mayors and leaders that it will probably take you until the almost end of your first term for you to really have the right group of people. But I think going out, she has assembled a good team in place that can continue to make sure that the city is well run.
Yeah, it's not okay for it to take 4 years to get the right team. One thing that the mayor said on there was that this is how it works. You know, people often find that it's in the fourth year that things come together. You know, that is not my experience in the offices of elected officials where I have worked. You know, from day one in Governor Deal's office, and I was one of the day one people, we had a really strong team around us. And thank God we did. We were going through the depths of the Great Recession and a lot of difficult decisions, and a lot of governing was required. I have found, to the mayor's defense, at the same time, that mass firings as you come in are a bad idea. You do need institutional knowledge. You do need some degree of continuity. And, you know, you don't see the huge bureaucracies in the federal government overturned when new presidents take effect. You do see new political appointees, but nevertheless, a lot of continuity. And that is important to a well-governed society. So I'll give her a little bit of grace on that, but a lot of those folks should have been gone a lot earlier than they were.
But one thing, again, I want to say is what the mayor said, and again, she doesn't need me to defend her or promote her. She did it with her interview in Rose, but I just want to make sure that we don't confuse our listeners. You know, she had a senior leadership team that was in place for the moment. I mean, she got through a ransomware attack. She also talked about that. She also talked about family. You know, let's not leave that out. I think Rose was able to highlight that, and that this was a personal decision for her. But it is typical for administrations to start with a team, many of whom you start with your campaign team, like Brian and his former colleague, Chris Riley, were all on the campaign. They came over. But there's also the instance, too, Dennis, where sometimes campaign staffers are not the best governing staffers, too.
This is true. I will echo that.
So again, what she meant and what she said, and I know it because I was close to it, is that now she has a senior team, a senior cabinet in place, where these are the people that she knows that, number one, are loyal, the number two are coming to City Hall every day, or we're logging in virtually every day to do City Hall work, that are ethical and that they are in it for the right reasons. And they have now been able to adapt to her leadership style. And so now as she leaves, you know, it's going to be up to the next person to deal with that.
I want to finish up with two things here. One, and Theron alluded to this, but I do think things got better under Bottoms when the chief of staff, Carmen Chubb, came in. Second, on the Bottoms interview with our friend Rose, this is something that is a sweet spot for the mayor. She's good in the media. She has great camera presence. She has a soothing voice that is effective, you know. And I have said this for 4 years on this show, or 3 years, I guess. Why is she not using those talents more effectively? You know, we saw it last year during the riots in Atlanta when the mom came out and she spoke to the city as a mom, and the city responded to her as their mom. It was very effective. She was a leader. She was visionary, and she has that ability. But she let those talents rot on the vine for too much of this term. I wish we would have seen a little more of it.
Another familiar political name is thinking about a campaign again, but this time a different campaign. Republican State House Speaker David Ralston is at least considering a U.S. Senate run. Brian, very quickly, does this indicate something that a lot of Republicans have pointed out, that up until now, there haven't been a whole lot of what you might consider the more likely big name suspects willing to take on sitting Senator Raphael Warnock?
I think the field does feel wide open. And of course, you know, full disclosure, I have to always do this. I am involved in one of those Senate races that is ongoing, that is already announced. Speaker Ralston has been an important leader in the state for not just the 11 years now that he's been Speaker, but has been in positions of service in the General Assembly long before that. And there are days where he's the most powerful politician in the state. That's a lot of power to give up to go be one of 100, where you know, in your later years, your senior years,
you're a junior senator. You're not Speaker anymore.
Exactly. You're a junior senator. You're the end of the seniority list. And that's a very tough transition to make. I think at the end of the day, he has earned the right to kick the tires, because he has been an important part of building this state up. And his fingerprints are all over state law today. I think what will happen is he'll kick the tires and eventually will stay where he is needed most, which is in the state house.
Theron, would Democrats be concerned should Speaker Ralston decide to run? Because he is someone who certainly comes from a place of working across the aisle, can appeal to Republicans who may have fled the party in the last election and might come home for somebody like Speaker Ralston.
It was my intent to actually try to speak with Speaker Ralston before we taped this podcast, but I was unfortunately not able to. So I do plan on reaching out to him and not just having a conversation about him possibly being a Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, but just to kind of touch bases with him. You know, Brian was able to work his magic to get the speaker on this podcast, and we had a very good conversation with him. And he made it clear that, you know, we have a good working relationship together. However, I think I agree with Brian. He has the right to explore it. I think that there's a certain wing of the Republican Party that he still represents, and that is a more moderate, less Trump loyalist portion of the party that feels left out and think that maybe a leader like Speaker Ralston can actually talk to them. But I do think that at a time where we're getting ready to go through redistricting, at a time where you got some vulnerable Republican House members that I know the Speaker wants to position to be able to try to get reelected, where Democrats, we're targeting those areas with data and resources and trying to find good candidates. I think that's a lot for him to give up to go and run against in a field that may have another Republican who will probably jump in that's more right of the Speaker. And to give that power up that he has right now in Georgia is a very, very tough decision for him. I would say I have not talked to him, but I would suspect that a lot of this is the speaker is very strategic politically to say, I'm going to keep my name out there as long as I can to have some very uncomfortable conversations within the GOP about who should run. But ultimately, whoever that person is, I think that Senator and Pastor Raphael Warnock is definitely doing a wonderful job in the U.S. Senate, has positioned himself not only financially, but politically to be reelected in the state.
We have just a couple of minutes to pick up here on COVID-19. The state's numbers in terms of cases and deaths continue to improve. But this came as an Atlanta Journal-Constitution investigation found that the advisory board to the State Department of Public Health did not meet at all about the coronavirus following an initial briefing in February of last year. Brian, these would have been public meetings during which the health department's response to the pandemic could have been discussed. And this week, Health Commissioner Dr. Kathleen Toomey said, we're not out of the woods yet. So doesn't this investigation add fuel to the criticism that the state's response has been political, opaque, and confusing?
This is exactly the kind of story that would drive me nuts when I was the communications director for the governor. You know, it's like, come on, people, listen to reason. No one could argue that the commissioner, Kathleen Toomey, who was highly qualified for the job, an incredible resume before she was Georgia Public Health Commissioner. No one could say that she wasn't available to the public. She was holding daily news conferences with the governor. The people who are on that board, like Kathleen Toomey, are also highly impressive people.
And
people
appointed by the governor himself.
Appointed by the governor, and they were on the front lines of this pandemic here in Georgia as well. To suggest that because there wasn't a formal meeting that these experts weren't consulted is contradicted by the evidence presented by the administration. Toomey did speak with board members. Their input was there, and I reject any idea, any suggestion that they skirted transparency by not having meetings. They were out front, not once a month in board meetings, but every day. And I can assure you that the viewpoints, the knowledge, the real world experiences of healthcare providers in our state were being represented to the commissioner through those board meetings in constant phone calls. You know, I serve on a board myself. When we get on a call, we are just as effective as we are sitting around a table in a boardroom. And that is what you saw here. I think it's a silly argument.
I just hope what Brian is saying is true. I have no reason not to believe him. But I've said this many times on this podcast. Again, have no reason to believe that anyone in state government or leadership tried to not meet or withhold information that they knew was going to have a deadly impact on Georgians. But I do think it's the rule in politics. You know, what did you know? When did you know it? And what did you do about it once you actually knew it was a problem? And I think the level of transparency during that period is going to continue to be highlighted in many more press stories like this one.
And perhaps in a campaign in 2022?
Yeah. I mean, look, Brian has made it very clear on this podcast, and I think he's right, that Governor Kemp is going to be judged on many things, but I think the top two, or maybe a list of five, is going to be how did he handle this deadly pandemic in the state of Georgia? And then what did he do around getting people the vaccines? And thirdly, how was the economy affected when he made a decision not to close or not to put in mask mandates, to reopen schools, to reopen businesses? I think three of those things are going to be very instrumental in the next governor's race in Georgia.
God, I hope Theron's right about that. God, I hope he's right, because Kemp's record is stellar. It is exemplary. He is a model for the rest of the nation to follow in how he handled all of those things.
I don't know if many Democrats would say it's stellar, but you know, we'll have to wait and see what the election results are.
I bet the Democrats who own tattoo parlors and bowling alleys think he's great.
As we close out here, of course, we are all sports fans, the participants in this podcast, and there was a lot of sports news in Atlanta. Julio Jones is out of here, apparently. Congratulations to Emory University, which won national titles in men's and women's tennis in Division III. But the big story, of course, the Atlanta Hawks advancing in the playoffs after a tough start to the season. They beat the New York Knicks in five games. Suddenly, Theron, there are a whole lot of Hawks fans who haven't been Hawks fans in a while.
Hey, two quick things. One, shout out to the Hawks. I mean, ice cold Trae Young. I mean, I'm over here just cold, not because I'm a member of Alpha Phi Alpha, which is, you know, we like to say we're ice cold, but, you know, we're over here shimmering because, you know, he's definitely showed up. And I love the little sort of thing that he does when he's rubbing his shoulders, basically saying, you know, I'm putting on a cold performance. And then I think, you know, secondly, I mean, the Atlanta Falcons, come on, guys. We cannot lose Julio Jones. I mean, I'm a huge Julio Jones fan, and my wife is tired of me talking about it. But, I mean, we got to figure out a way to keep Julio Jones in Atlanta. He is Atlanta. Yeah, a little banged up every now and then, but, you know, that's NFL football. But we got to figure out a way to keep Julio Jones in Atlanta.
I'm more than happy to be on the Hawks bandwagon. I did watch the Wednesday night game, and it was fantastic. I mean, just an utter beatdown, a throttling.
In Madison Square Garden, we should
point out.
Yeah,
even better, right? We can just shove it in the face of that communist mayor who was putting shots at us. And so that was all sweet. I do want to, on the flip side, raise an issue. I don't like the hashtag Believe Atlanta. That is tone deaf. It is blind to our history of heartache. Look, any Atlantan who believes is incapable of learning or is ignorant of what has happened here through the years. So I'm not going to believe until there are rings handed out in this city. And that tends to never happen. And we also prove that we're the best team over and over again, only to come up with creative ways to blow it. So nobody's, I'm for you. I'm pulling for the Hawks 100%. But no, I ain't going to believe.
Oh, come on, Brian. You got to believe. And look, Dennis, I got to do this because I got a lot of friends who went to Emory. We can't look them over. I mean, that was a huge win for the tennis team. I mean, someone who's trying to learn how to play more tennis. I know it's a very hard sport. So shout out to Emory men and women's tennis team for winning the national championship.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, a public affairs and government consultant, and most recently, a senior advisor to the Biden Georgia campaign. Thanks so much to you both.
All aboard the Hawks bandwagon.
Let's go Hawks. I believe even if Brian doesn't.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale. That's T-I-N-S-D-A-L-E. Theron Johnson is at Theron Johnson. And I'm at D-E-N-I-S-O-H-A-Y-E-R. Our thanks to Kevin Rinker and Lowell Berlanti for their production assistance. And if you like this show, please subscribe. It is free wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That, of course, is a great way to make sure other people can find us. And don't forget all the other great podcasts from WABE. There's up-to-the-minute information on the coronavirus, on Did You Wash Your Hands with Sam Whitehead, a deep dive into the politics and money in one corner of the gun debate. Lisa Hagen brings you No Compromise. And then there's the Peabody Award-winning Buried Truths. Hank Klibanoff unearths details about the murder of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick. And right here on The Political Breakfast, we'll be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us and have a great and a safe week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.